you know where we all live at the Alfred, we're all having to move around the corner to the American Embassy. But I'm still in my office. I haven't been chiseled out yet. I think I'll be holding onto the desk. I'm still there. The Alfred's still there. These are my disclosures. So I thought I'd just go through a little bit of an update on androgen physiology and then the sort of general issues about androgen replacement in women. So this is what we were all brought up to consider, that the adrenals predominantly produce pre-androgens. The ovaries produce the pre-androgens and testosterone, and the pre-androgens are peripherally converted into testosterone, which is further converted into dihydrotestosterone peripherally, and that testosterone and DHT are the potent androgens. So again, that depicts this, and this is particularly on adrenal steroid synthesis. But what we now know is that the adrenals, in women at least, produce vast quantities of 11-hydroxyandrosterone. In fact, the adrenals produce more of this than they produce androstenedione. And peripherally, this is converted to 11-ketotestosterone, and I haven't shown you here in this slide, but onward to 11-ketodihydrotestosterone. So there are important things about these compounds. Firstly, that they're not aromatizable. And secondly, that they're equipotent on the androgen receptor as testosterone and dihydrotestosterone. So this really raises a whole lot of questions, where in the past we've done these very elaborate studies looking to see the relationship between testosterone and various outcomes in women, for example, sexual function, we might have been measuring the wrong androgens. There's a lot of interest, particularly in these compounds, in congenital adrenal hyperplasia and PCOS. And again, we've all seen the girl who presents with terrible hirsutism, and you measure her androgen profile, and it's not particularly exciting. And it might well be that these compounds fill in gaps in the story that we've never really understood. So now what we see is a different diagram, because I've had to add into my old diagram 11-ketodihydrotestosterone, 11-ketotestosterone, which are not 5-alpha reduced or aromatized, or the 11-keto is 5-alpha reduced, not aromatized to estrogens. And then we'd also need to be mindful that people get very fixated on hormone levels, and particularly, you know, digressing to estrogen levels in women, I'm seeing a lot of people measuring estrogen levels in hormone replacement and saying, oh, they're not getting enough estrogen. And we forget that the complexity of sex steroid metabolism, a lot of it's intracellular, and then even particularly with estrogens and androgens, the metabolism is often tissue specific, so different tissues have different upregulators and downregulators at the DNA level, so that we cannot ever say that one size fits all, or that we should ever treat to a particular hormone level. And particularly in general practice, I'm seeing that's being forgotten, because people are measuring estrogen levels with estrogen replacement therapy, which is basically useless. So the primary reason for using testosterone in 2017 to treat a woman is for sexual dysfunction. There are potentially going to be a lot of other benefits, but there is not sufficient data to actually use it for any other indication, and certainly there aren't sufficient clinical trials to advocate the use of testosterone for other purposes. So when we talk about sexual dysfunction, it gets even more confusing. The main areas we talk about are low sexual desire and low arousal. There's also female orgasmic disorder, sexual pain disorder, and the DSM-5 has got the persistent arousal disorder. And there's an international warfare going on about what are the right classifications. So the DSM-4 had various classifications, and then a group of people came out and argued that the DSM-5 one should be different. So one of the main contentious points is that the DSM-5 can combine desire and arousal as a single disorder, whereas the International Society of Sexual Medicine have retained them as completely separate disorders for a number of reasons. And the diagnosis is very arbitrary, and we also forget that people switch between spaces. So a woman at one period of time might have low desire, and another period of time her problem might be anorgasmia, and another time it might be low arousal. So people aren't always in the same box, because we're dynamic individuals. And the other problem is defining. So the definition is for the DSM-5, for example, for sexual interest arousal disorder, the woman has to have at least 6 months of the problem for at least 75% of the time. Now, I don't think, we don't require our patients to have a migraine for 70%, a third of the time or 20% of the time, or you don't, to have back pain, chronic severe back pain, you don't have to have it for 75% of the time. And you think about asking your patients, now, if you had this for 75% of the time, it's like, well, okay, so when I didn't have a problem, I used to think about sex maybe 3 times a week. And now I only think about 1% a week. That's only 30% of the time difference. I mean, so that, you've got to wonder. None of this is evidence-based is really what I'm telling you. It's a whole lot of people get together in somewhere like Madrid and have a meeting where they all share opinions, and then 3 or 4 people write the paper, and then everybody else ticks it off. So a lot of this is not evidence-based. But on conversation with a patient, if a woman presents that she is particularly personally bothered by persistent low desire and or arousal, and when you do questionnaires, they really overlap, that concerns her, that you look at other factors involved, or potential factors like, does she actually like her partner? And you would be surprised by the number of people who come back and say, I had one woman who came back and said, I fixed it. I said, what did you do? She said, I left him. I was never going to do that, fix it for her. So it really, you really are having to sit down and talk to the patient in this space. So we wanted to know how many women were so affected. So we did a cross-sectional study of 2020 women aged 40 to 65 recruited through the Australian electoral roll. They are representative of Australian women in terms of employment, partnership status, smoking, BMI, and a whole slew of other things. And this is what we found. Of otherwise healthy in the women in the community, just on 70% have low desire using validated structured questionnaires. And women are more likely to have low desire if they are unpartnered. Well, that's sort of not rocket science. However, they're more likely to be distressed by their low desire or have sexually associated distress if they are partnered. Because if you've got low desire and you've got a partner and it's not working, you're more likely to be distressed. And again, using a validated questionnaire. And hyperactive sexual desire disorder was present in overall 1 in 3 women of this age and 40% of partnered women of this age. So it's a common problem we're not addressing and we're not talking about. So one of my patients got very irate with me and she said, how come you're not doing research that involves people like me? And she's about 75. And that made me feel really bad. And I tried to convince John McNeil, who heads up the Asprey trial, which has got 16,000 people aged 70 plus, to put some sexual function questionnaires in the study. And John said no, because people might stop participating in the study. They'll be offended by your questions. So we went out and we recruited 1,500 women aged 65 to 80 from across Australia. And there are two really interesting things about this. Using the Roy Morgan database, which is based on the electoral roll, it's constantly turning over, it's validated. We recruited those 1,500 women aged 65 to 80 within 3 weeks. So these women were desperate to be heard. The other study, the younger women, we recruited over 3 to 4 months. These women were recruited in 3 weeks, and about 90% of them completed the sexual function questionnaire. And when we recruited them, we told them it was a study of older women's health, because we were actually looking at menopausal symptoms. We didn't tell them there would be any sexual function questionnaires in the study, and yet they completed them. So it sort of breaks down a lot of misunderstandings about older people's sexual health. And this is the data. So partnered, non-partnered, sexually active, sexually inactive. So the sexually inactive women have the highest rates of low desire. Well, they're not interested, then that's fine. And what we found was that 32%, so about a third of partnered sexually active women had low desire that interfered with their well-being. That it was lower in the non-partnered sexually active women. But the other point here is that don't assume because your 75-year-old female patient is not partnered that she's not sexually active. Because, and that she may not be, and that she may also be bothered and have distress because of low sexual desire. And then, you know, not surprisingly, the non-partnered sexually inactive women have the lowest concerns and the lowest rate of hyperactive sexual desire disorder because clearly they're not, you know, sexually active, they're not seeking a partner. It may well just not be of interest to them, and that's fine too. You don't have to treat it. Not everybody's got a problem with this, but I think this sort of screams at you that one in three partnered sexually active women had a problem. And I don't have the data, the numbers there, but that was a vast proportion of the partnered women were sexually active. So our research has shown that testosterone is effective for the treatment of low desire and low arousal in surgically postmenopausal women who are just taking estrogen, whether it be oral or transdermal, in naturally postmenopausal women on estrogen plus progestin. And then we did the Big Aphrodite study where we looked at 800 women across three continents and they were not on hormone replacement therapy, and we showed that testosterone improved sexual well-being and was effective and safe. And then we've done two studies looking at premenopausal women aged 35 to 45 and shown significant improvements in sexual function in those women who have low desire with distress. So women, I haven't shown you the slide from Sonia Davis's PhD, but many of you have seen it, that testosterone levels do not change across natural menopause. If a woman gets to 52 from natural menopause and she's got low testosterone, she probably had it before she went through menopause. The testosterone levels fall in the late reproductive years and are probably a hallmark of granulosa cell function. And presently we're involved in a very large European study looking at testosterone supplementation for poor responders to IVF. So what does the data look like? So this is from two surgically menopausal women studies, and they each involved about 250 women in each treatment group. So in fact, when we're looking at this, we're looking at about 1,000 women. And what you see is that you get a significant improvement over baseline in satisfying sexual events. So whether a woman keeps a diary and they report they've had sex, is it satisfying or not? Black and white. Not maybe, a bit, but black and white. And that was seen in both studies. Improved sexual desire over baseline and significant statistical reduction in personal distress. Now, all these women were on Premarin. And Procter & Gamble, who developed it, realized that they spent a bucket load of money unnecessarily, because if you're on Premarin, it increases your sex hormone binding globulin, and if your SHBG goes up, testosterone doesn't work. And they realized later that they would have been much cheaper and they could have shown efficacy much earlier if they'd had their patients on estrogen patches. So in this study, the domains of arousal, orgasm, pleasure, concerns, responsiveness, and self-image all improved statistically. And then we went on and did a study looking at the women who were naturally menopausal, and if their SHBG was less than 160 nanomoles per litre, which was the upper limit of the assay that was used at that time, there was a significant increase in satisfactory sexual events, on average 2 a month, and that was the overall group. So there was a greater improvement in that setting. So we went on and looked at placebo versus the low dose versus the standard dose of the testosterone patch, and this is a study involving 800 women and about 280 in each group. Oh no, there were more in each group. And we looked at satisfactory sexual events, and what you see is this is the baseline number of events, and you see a significant improvement over baseline with a 300 microgram dose. So basically doubling of the 80% increase in the number of sexual events, a 30% increase here. And there was about 120% increase in frequency of orgasm in the treated group with the 300 patch. And then we looked at whether it was related to satisfactory sexual activity at baseline. So for example, if a woman said that she was never had an event at baseline that was satisfying, does that mean she wouldn't respond? But in fact, the response rate was pretty even, irrespective of what baseline satisfactory sexual activity was like. So what we did was exclude from all these studies women on antidepressant or with depression, because that in itself is a cause of low desire and arousal and antidepressants with anorgasmia. But 56% of women on SSRIs have sexual dysfunction, and it's a very common cause of cessation of therapy. So we looked at that population. So we did a randomized placebo-controlled trial in Australia of women that were on a stable SSRI and they had to have treatment emergent sexual dysfunction. And what we found is they looked just like all the other women we treated with a testosterone patch before. We used the same testosterone patch, and we found on average a doubling of satisfactory sexual events over baseline in these women. So it's a good therapy to consider for women who have these problems on an SSRI. So then comes the minefield, what to do about treatment. And this is really what it looks like. The International Society of Sexual Medicine have just put together a process of care, and it's under review at the moment. We've developed algorithms to try and make it easier to assess the patient. You know, how do you come to the point going down the algorithm that the woman might merit treatment? But really, you've got to take a detailed history. I'm actually horrified by the number of patients, if I ask them if they've ever had physical, sexual, or psychological abuse, that actually answer yes. Particularly the number of women that I cannot believe that they tell me stories of sexual abuse. I'm surprised, you know, I shouldn't be surprised. It's common, and it goes across all socio-demographic boundaries. And women will often say, I've never talked to anyone about it before. So you do have to ask about that. The other issue is about simply people understanding sex. Sex is everywhere. And yet people don't understand sexuality. So often referral to a counselor to actually talk women through sexual function. You know, the classic is the patient who I've seen for 10 years for osteoporosis, mid to late 50s, three children, works in a professional occupation, and one day she just sort of was still in the room, she sort of wasn't leaving, and she said to me, oh, you do this stuff with testosterone? I go, yeah. And then she starts telling me she's never had an orgasm, she's never asked anyone about it. It's never occurred, she's never had the courage to discuss it with anybody, and yet she'd been seeing me for 10 years. And so I think one of the things is giving patients permission to have the conversation as well. And even if you're not comfortable about the conversation, if you ask them about it, and do they have any sexual concerns, if you're not comfortable, then refer, say, I can refer you on. But it's terribly important. So who benefits? Women in their late reproductive years and beyond who say that they've experienced a distinct change and they don't like not feeling sexual. And women with the following conditions: surgical menopause, talk about it because they've lost half their testosterone production. Primary ovarian insufficiency, you see a young girl with Turner syndrome, she's virtually never had much testosterone. And the other ones are women with adrenal insufficiency, because when you give, and that's iatrogenic too, so when you treat with prednisolone for any other condition other than just adrenal insufficiency, you're wiping out 50% of the testosterone production. So women with conditions like rheumatoid arthritis or severe asthma who end up on chronic prednisolone, by the time they're in their 50s and their ovaries aren't making a lot of testosterone and you wipe it out with the glucocorticosteroid therapy, they've got very little testosterone left. And there's no upper age limit. I have patients in their 80s on testosterone. But treatment is a trial. It's absolutely suck it and see, because there's no blood level that helps you make a decision who not to treat or who to treat. But women are unlikely to benefit if they are young and have regular ovarian cycles. So I'm talking about a 28-year-old who comes in for testosterone. She has monthly regular cycles. She's not on the pill. She's got a testosterone surge mid-cycle, otherwise she won't be ovulating. She's got other problems. Women in poor relationships, and here's the problem. Is the poor relationship because the woman's withdrawn from sex, and that's caused a huge amount of friction, or is the poor relationship the primary problem? And sometimes it's actually secondary to the woman's loss of desire and loss of interest, a loss of arousal and willingness to participate. Women on high dose oral estrogen will not benefit. You've got to get them off the oral estrogen. And women with other sexual problems. So the first thing is to note whether the problem is recent or lifelong. If it's lifelong, you're not going to fix them with hormones. So if they've never experienced satisfactory sexual function, giving testosterone is not going to be the answer. What blood tests will... Testosterone is highly protein bound. You all know that. And therefore, we always measure sex hormone binding globulin as well as measuring testosterone. The things that will influence SHBG need to be considered, and that includes oral estrogen and oral thyroxine. And then people with a high fructose diet or visceral adiposity will have low SHBG. So we don't, you all know this stuff, I'm preaching to the converted here, but the best option is a reliable total testosterone assay. I do not use the free androgen index for anything. I go, if I get a SHBG and a total testosterone and not a calculated free, I just go onto the web and get it, go onto one of the testosterone calculators, plug in the number, and it gives you the free testosterone level. Measurement of DHEA sulfate and sex hormone binding globulin is robust. So there is simply no level of testosterone that will guide you in therapy, other than if a woman has a high normal testosterone, you're obviously not going to treat her. So why do we measure testosterone at all? Primarily to avoid measuring the occasional woman you do see who presents with all the concerns and problems, and yet she actually has a testosterone profile where her free testosterone is right up high. To avoid treating women with high SHBG, and to be very cautious treating women with low SHBG, because they will clear the testosterone you administer very quickly out of their circulation. The contraindications are current androgen excess, hormone-dependent malignancy, and I re-emphasize very low SHBG because you need very judicious dosing. So how do we treat women? You do need to go through the psychosocial issues. My kids call me a sex counselor, not an endocrinologist. You need to review all their medications. Just like men, you need to look at the antihypertensives, etc. Consider concurrent medical conditions. Treat vaginal atrophy. So in our study of these women aged 65 to 80 across Australia, 1,500 women, one in three said that they had vaginal dryness during sexual activity in the past month. So 30% of our older women had been sexually active in the past month, and or more than, and at least one in three had vaginal dryness. Only 6% of women aged 40 to 80 in Australia are currently receiving vaginal estrogen for any reason. It's on the PBS. It is cheap. It is effective. It doesn't cause breast cancer or heart disease, but it will alleviate a lot of distress amongst women and their partners, and I simply can't understand why it's so underprescribed. So treatment of vaginal atrophy is appropriate. Tibolone I'll put where available because I just used some of these slides overseas, and the Americans missed out. They don't have tibolone. Tibolone can be effective, not in everyone, but it can have weak efficacy in terms of sexual function. So I strongly oppose the use of transdermal male formulations for women because it's so easy to imprecisely overdose. We don't use injectables in women, and I think Carolyn's already convinced you why in general that's not a good idea. I don't like prescribing testosterone undecanoate for women, and I feel very strongly also against about the use of compounded preparations. I see all sorts of blood levels with compounded creams, atrocious and things. This is a study done by Hale and Buckland many years ago looking at oral testosterone undecanoate, and of women, a 20 milligram and a 40 milligram dose. This woman, she had much higher blood levels, up to 40 nanomoles per litre with a 20 milligram dose, but rather than when she got the 40 milligram dose. And these are four individual women, and it just shows you the unpredictability of absorption and bioavailability. The testosterone patch was approved in Europe. It was never approved in the US, and it's no longer available. But I have colleagues absolutely on the warpath to try and resurrect the testosterone patch for women, Americans, who see it as their duty of care to women before they retire. And they're seriously working hard now. We are really fortunate to have the testosterone cream. And I don't think, and I have no shares in the company, okay? But I don't think we realize how lucky we are with this, because when I give talks overseas, people say, well, you say don't use male formulations and you say don't use compounded formulations. How on earth do we treat these women? And they really do have to, in the US Endocrine Society Androgens for Women guidelines, we finally have to come to an agreement that the guidelines say in many countries you have no choice but to use compounded testosterone for women. And then we implemented all the guidance that I recommend for Androfem in Australia. We have done pharmacokinetics. One of my PhD students, NC Filardi, did this study looking at a 0.5 milligram dose and the 1 mil, which is a 10 milligram dose. This is the uncorrected median value. And you can see the range in picomoles per liter. So 5 picomoles per litre is about 19, sorry, picograms per mil, 5 picomoles per litre is about 19, I'm going, 5 picograms per mil is about 5 picomoles per litre. And so this is below, this is sort of around about 14 to 15, you're seeing this line at. And you get a pretty steady state over 24 hours. The higher dose, you really risk going up into high levels of testosterone. So we recommend a starting dose of 0.5 mil applied. I recommend it be applied between the knee and the waist. I don't like it being applied on the arms, one, because you can transfer it to a child or another person. Mainly you worry about children with women. A lot of women are carers for grandchildren and stuff. There's a lovely study that showed with an estrogen spray on the arm that women got ipsilateral nipple pigmentation. So you get lymphatic drainage from the arm to the breast. So that's why I recommend you don't put it on the arm as well. Get their blood drawn, their levels are through the roof. I just had someone the other day, her testosterone level was 9 picomoles per litre thereabouts, and I rang her up and I said, where are you putting it? On my arm. Where the blood was drawn from. Implants we have used for decades. There is a 100 milligram testosterone implant called Testabel. It's FDA approved. It's sold to a pharmacy in the US, in the UK as well. And I've got TGA approval through the authorized prescriber scheme to import it. And others interested can import it, but you've got to go through the authorised prescriber scheme. And it's very effective, and I'm using 50 milligram implant, or cut the implant in half and use 50 milligrams. There are a lot of people using compounded implants, and they're really scary. You get massive supraphysiological levels. Someone in the US has just published data from compounded implants, and the levels are all over the shop. And you just don't know what you're putting in women, really. There are really no risks of physiological testosterone therapy. The only problem is if women start to use too much testosterone, it gets really concerning. This is from all the testosterone patch studies. So over 3,000 women treated with patch, and just under 2,000 got placebo, and there's no increase in cardiovascular disease, looking at all cardiovascular events. This is breast cancer data. This is all observational data. It's a bit messy. The increase here with the Hewitt study was a testosterone injection 6 weekly, and the reason why the women were getting it is unclear. But the majority of studies show no increased risk. Tamimi looked at conjugated equine estrogen and methyl testosterone, as did Ness and Jick, and two out of the three get different responses. But overall, there appears to be no increased risk. This is what you see in terms of androgenic adverse effects. No difference in acne, alopecia, or voice deepening in the big study that we did. You do get increased hair growth. So a lot of women say, I'm shaving my legs again, or I'm shaving my underarms again. This isn't actually all hirsutism. Occasionally, of course, you get women who get hirsutism with testosterone. So this is what we put in the Endocrine Society statement. It's a trial of 3 to 6 months. If a woman hasn't responded by 6 months, stop. We always measure testosterone levels after about 3 to 6 weeks. Women won't have had a benefit. You see the benefit at about 6 to 8 weeks, but I like to see what they're putting on their skin before they've got a problem. And occasionally I have to ring a patient up and say, you're using too much. And continued review, because women will go off into the blue yonder and just keep putting hormones on their skin, and then gradually they get slack, and then they start using too much, and then they get problems. So we've got decades of experience with testosterone in women. We've got RCTs that show no adverse events. If I'm correct, that, you know, the GLP agonists or antagonists, I don't even do diabetes, were proved up with 6 months of data by the FDA. And yet we've got years of experience with this. Women are out there in their hundreds using compounded testosterone. So I think the regulators are covering their own asses, because they won't approve testosterone for women because they don't have to control, they have no responsibility for compounded therapy. The TGA has no responsibility for compounded therapy. It's not their problem because it's not a regulated compound. But they won't approve testosterone for women, as you've heard. So that's leaving our women having to use a lot of other therapies and anti-aging clinics and all sorts of things. And I really think that they should be looking at the needs of the community. And for those of interested in menopause, there's a good reason to go to Vancouver next year to the World Congress on the Menopause. And I'll stop. Thank you.